Hi everyone, Jason here. On May the 14th, Stephen and myself will be appearing with the one and only Mark Lewison at the Pavilion Theatre in Dunleary, Dublin. We're going to be celebrating 60 years of A Hard Day's Night, and we would love you to join us. For tickets, go to paviliontheatre.ie or nothingisrealpod.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to Nothing Is Real, a podcast about the Beatles. Everybody thinks they know the Beatles, but how much do we really know? My name is Jason Carty.
My name is Stephen Cockcroft.
And we are live on tape from Dublin and Belfast. This is part two of us talking about Come Together, You Can't Catch John Lennon, more or less. In the first part, you might recall, we talked about how John brought this song to the Beatles, recorded it quite quickly, put it out, it became a massive hit, and then it turned into a massive legal headache. And where we left it last week, 1972 was becoming into 1973, and we have what's euphemistically called, if we raise the curtain on, the 1973 settlement, where it all goes away, and this could potentially be our shortest podcast ever.
Yes, it's great. It's the way legal stuff should work.
Right. So, what happens?
Well, in the back end of 1973, the parties are gearing up for a trial. It's going to be heard in the New York Federal District Court in front of a judge called Thomas Greaser. I think I'm pronouncing that right. I want to say Greaser. Mm-hmm. I want to say Greaser.
Greaser.
In a 1950s way. But so we remember that name, Judge Thomas Greaser.
Remember that name, folks.
They're gearing up. Levy is all set to call Chuck Berry as a witness. That would be good. I mean, you'd pay money to go to a court to see Chuck Berry on a witness stand.
You wonder, you know, we talked last week about, you know, did John and Chuck discuss this at all when they met in February 72 at Mike Douglas? At which point is Chuck brought in or put on the hook for this, you know? So if Levy feels he can use Chuck as his in his defense, obviously there's still enough goodwill between Levy and Chuck.
Well, you've got to wonder what Chuck Berry would make of all of this, or what his attitude to all of this would be, because undoubtedly he is one of those artists, those kind of founding fathers of rock and roll that were terribly ripped off over publishing rights and things like that. So, you know, eventually he will get these copyrights back. But at this time, as you say, he really doesn't have much skin in the game.
He's no power.
I genuinely, if I had been advising John Lennon, I would have been saying, let's get Chuck on our side. You know, to say that he doesn't care and he doesn't hear any similarity. But anyway, Levy is gearing up to call Chuck as a witness. The trial is scheduled for the 12th of October. The judge, by all accounts, is tremendously excited to be hearing this big high-profile case. I read an article about this, and it said he had invited his wife to come and sit in on the trial because, you know, it was a big Beatles law court case. And then the night before the trial, there is a settlement.
Well, such is the will of these kind of things, where they go right up to the wire in order to force a settlement.
And yeah,
the settlement is on October the 11th, 73, 2 days after John Lennon's 33rd birthday, pointedly. So what is the settlement that they reach?
Right. Have you got a pen and paper handy?
Well, I do. But this has ramifications for what John Lennon does for the next couple of years.
Yes. Now, bear in mind, you said in part one, you know, John Lennon needed to have good lawyers around him. And I think he probably has decent lawyers at this stage. You know, we're right at the door of the court. This is a legal settlement. The lawyers put this together and all is well. So this is sort of this 1973 settlement, let's call it, is the kind of making this litigation go away. So Big Seven agreed to withdraw the complaint in exchange for John's undertaking that his next album would contain him singing renditions of You Can't Catch Me and two other songs for which Big Seven held the copyright, and it was entirely up to John what those would be. These were penciled in as Angel Baby by Rosie and the Originals and Ya Ya by Lee Dorsey, both of which had hit the top 10 in 1961. But Lennon had the right to change his mind about those as long as he was recording two other songs for which Big Seven held the copyright. And...
Well, before we get to the and, because the and is crazy.
It's nuts.
It's nuts. But that seems reasonable. Big Seven will go away. John says, I'll record three of your songs on an album. And he also says it'll be my next album.
Yes.
So remember that. I'll record three Big Seven copyrights on my next album. Next is the important bit.
Yeah.
And Big Seven think, okay, you know, that'll give us a bit of a payday, and makes Big Seven go away. And, you know, I think the general thing is that, you know, there's no liability. There's no admission of copyright infringement or anything from Come Together. Come Together gets to, as a song, as an entity, gets to ride off into the sunset unharmed. And that would be a reasonable enough settlement. But there's this and, which is the weirdest agreement ever, and makes me think that John didn't have good lawyers. So yes. What's the and?
Lennon agrees to, quote, use his best efforts to secure the licensing to Big Seven of three songs from the Apple non-Beatle catalogue currently in print. So this is essentially records by other Apple artists, excluding only those songs composed by John Lennon and Yoko Ono Lennon together, and those songs composed by Paul McCartney and Linda McCartney together. So everything else is up for grabs.
So a, you know, a Badfinger song, or, you know, a Mary Hopkins song or something.
Billy Preston. Yes. I mean, nuts.
Nuts. So Lennon says, Big Seven, I'll record three of your songs and I'll find three Apple songs and I'll pull them from the Apple catalog and I'll give them to you. And but it's an Apple thing. So he has to get the Beatles to agree to this.
Yes. Yes. And this will come back into play. We'll see this because, again, in the context here, we're in late 1973. We know from our 1974 episode that will be the year in which the Beatles are sort of finally resolving their issues and bringing the partnership to an end. So this will come back into play in the context of those dissolution agreements.
And there's an agreement that if Lennon doesn't get Paul, George and Ringo to agree by December the 31st, 74, Lennon will record two more Big Seven songs on top of the three Big Seven songs he's already agreed to do. But it's a really odd, I mean, it's so unsound to say, well, I'll just go off and try to get this done. How do you define something like that? It's really weird.
Best efforts. Oh, there is so much case law on best efforts, reasonable efforts, all reasonable efforts. Yes, I could talk to you. The Blackpool Airport case is the big case there.
Okay, can that be summarized in 60 seconds, the Blackpool Airport case?
Reasonable efforts are, you know, we know what that means. You'll do your best. You'll make reasonable efforts. Best endeavors. Best efforts means you will, even if it means acting to your own commercial detriment, you must try. So I won't go through the Blackpool Airport case in detail, but basically if you are to act reasonably or use reasonable efforts, it that does not oblige you to act in your contrary to your own commercial interests. So if it's going to cost you money or whatever, if you say best endeavors, even if it costs you money to do that, you have to go ahead. So that's the broad distinction. But there is a whole raft of, and that's one of those phrases that people throw into agreements at the very last minute because they can't actually reach an agreement.
Right. So the main thrust of this is that on John's next album, he will record three songs owned by Big Seven. And It then brings the question, well, which came first, the chicken or the egg? Which came first, the court case or the rock and roll album? Because it just so happens, and John must have known this in the back of his mind, that the rock and roll album project had already begun even before this settlement came into place. So I think John saw, in modern parlance, a synergy where he could...
Absolutely.
One thing could feed the other.
Yes, this does make sense because he's working on his oldies project, and it's important to remember. I'm very fond of the rock and roll album. It comes out eventually in 1975. But
I am not fond of the rock and roll album. Just to state, must put my flag in the earth here.
Fair enough.
Continue. Proceed.
Carry on. Objection overruled.
Yes.
Yeah, but it's recorded in 1973, and 1973 was all about rock and roll. You know, it was all about there was a little kind of 50s revival. I know your favorite band, Sha-na-na. We're still going. This is the worst band ever. There was a kind of 50s nostalgia brewing in 1973, and John has decided, his last two albums, Sometime in New York City, Mind Games, have not been particularly well received. He's on a break from everything, and he decides that this would be a good thing just to do some old, just to kick back. And he talks about, spending 3 weeks trying to convince Phil Spector that he would like to do this. He's happy that Phil just takes up the production reins, that John is not going to interfere. He just wants to go in and sing. So it ties in perfectly. And by December 1973, he's recorded 8 tracks for the album, and in fact it's pretty much to finishing the whole thing. So he's recorded Boney Maroney, Sweet Little 16, Be My Baby, Just Because, My Baby Left Me, and then the 3 Big 7 songs, Angel Baby, Ya Ya, and You Can't Catch Me. That selection of songs is also quite interesting, apart from the 3 that he's obliged to record.
Well, should we talk about that now, or should we talk about it when he comes back into court to explain why he's done all of this?
Yeah, I can talk about it whenever.
I think it's interesting because, these songs appear on Rock and Roll, or they appear in this time, and there doesn't appear to be any reason as to why they're there. And we'll park that for a moment and come back to that in a bit. Timeline-wise, they have the agreement in October 73. Rock and Roll is brewing. By December 73, he's recorded the 3 songs. So even though they have been released, he has met that requirement quite quickly by recording Angel Baby, Ya Ya, and You Can't Catch Me. And it was all going so well. And then the album comes out straight away and everything's fine. Isn't that what happens?
That's absolutely it. Thank you.
No, because Phil Spector's involved.
Phil Spector is involved. Nothing about Phil is ever straightforward. And we kind of, one day we're going to do a day by day, hour by hour podcast on the rock and roll sessions. we did talk about this on our 1974 episode, so we'll not go into a lot of detail, but there is, John provides a useful summary at one point, and he says, one day when Phil didn't want to work, he called me and he said the studio had been burnt down. Now, in the early days, I didn't know, how far away Phil was. So I said, oh, the studio's burnt down. So anyway, a couple of hours passed, the studio was burnt down. I get somebody to call the studio. It hadn't been burnt down. That was the Sunday. The following Sunday, Phil calls and says, hey, Johnny. I said, oh, hi, Phil. What happened? We're supposed to be doing a session. And he says, I've got the John Dean tapes. I said, what? And he said, I've got the John Dean tapes. What he was telling me in his own sweet way was he had my tapes, not the John Dean Watergate tapes. He had my tapes locked in the cellar behind the barbed wire and the Afghan dogs and the machine guns. So that album was stopped in the middle for a year, and we had to sue through Capitol to get the tapes back off him.
What a strange time. I mean, John Dean is a curious reference because, Nixon doesn't resign till August 74, but the whole Watergate Senate hearings were going on between 73, 74. So, Watergate was the news topic at the time. And it's a time of kind of paranoia, tapes, craziness, people doing odd things. And so Phil Spector is just a man of his time.
Really. He is a man of his time. So yes, it comes out in those hearings that there actually is, in Nixon's case, a smoking gun, because he has thoughtfully recorded everything that was said in the Oval Office. And then there's a gap in the tapes. So presumably, what do you do if you're a congressional investigator? You give all the tapes to Phil Spector, the greatest record producer, and a stable hand to work out what's gone wrong.
The logic, if one word could be applied to Phil Spector, was that he had paid for the sessions out of his own pocket, and he'd felt that he had front-loaded his money into paying the players or the space or whatever. So, you know, Capital hadn't paid, he had paid. So he felt that he was entitled to keep the tapes himself.
Yes.
But then Capital have to try and work to get the tapes back.
And again, this seems very odd that Spectre has fronted up the cost of this. I mean, normally it's the record company, you know, traditionally or notoriously the record company will pay for the record sessions, and then the artist records something, puts it out, thinks they've made $1 million off the back of the record, and then they suddenly find the record company is recouping the recording costs. So, but in this case, Capital had only put up a few thousand dollars, and Phil Spector had put up something to the tune of maybe $90,000.
So this is the end of 73, start of 74. Lennon has recorded the three songs. They're in the bag, but Spector has taken them away. So this is not, there's a big kind of legal morass where this cannot be the next album, or it cannot be finished as the next album, because it's not until July 74 that Capital eventually pay Spector $90,000 and get the tapes back.
That's it. That's it. And the judge in the 1976 litigation gives a very neat little summary. And he said, Lennon was working with one Phil Spector, a successful producer of rock and roll records. At some point, these recording sessions terminated because of difficulties created by Spector. This is very nice legal language. The tapes of those songs which had been recorded were appropriated by Spector. Lennon could make no further progress. It was not until July 1974 that Lennon retrieved the Spector tapes and Capital paid Spector about $90,000. By this time, Lennon was working on another album entitled Walls and Bridges. He did not resume work on the rock and roll album. He wished to complete Walls and Bridges first.
And that's, I mean, the mantra that we keep saying is, we, you know, we talk about this on our 1974 episode, but, you know, the 1974, you know, if people have heard that, you know, Walls and Bridges, it's in what happens in between. So the first half of 1974, Lennon is in LA. He's kind of realizing that his Lost Weekend maybe might not be the best use of his time. And by the end of 74, he's back in New York City, more clear-headed, and, you know, Walls and Bridges bookends his LA time and his New York time, so to speak. So, but it comes back to this phrase we mentioned earlier on of his next album. So his next album is not going to be this rock and roll album. It's suddenly now going to be Walls and Bridges.
That's it. That's it. And that is really the key thing. Next album, there was that was built into the settlement. Now, there is a Big Seven track on Walls and Bridges.
Which is Yeah Yeah.
Yeah, terrible, terrible version.
Well, it's just, I mean, it's John and Julian kind of jamming. So teenage Julian. And I wonder, again, was it just expediency where John is like, oh, this is cute, you know, me and Julian jamming, and I can take the 60 seconds and keep Morris Levy off my back? Or did he just put it on thinking, ah, it's just nice to have Julian on the album?
I think it's just a kind of joke track, a kind of little hidden track, but in context, it's almost you know, an incitement to Levy. It's almost kind of like thumbing your nose at Levy. I haven't put out your three songs, but I'm just going to do this, and I'm going to do a really terrible version. It doesn't matter.
It still pays the bill.
Yeah, I was going to say it doesn't matter. Levy is getting the publishing every, and Walls and Bridges is a successful album. It's not one of my favorite albums, but it's a successful album. It's got number one single, so it is a reasonably successful album by mid-period 1970s John Lennon standards.
And Morris Levy, as we've already ascertained, a reasonable man, is quite happy that John Lennon's next album is Walls and Bridges. And he feels, that's okay, John, we'll get you the next time. Correct? No, not correct.
You're leading people astray here. So yeah, Levy is not happy. And he requests a meeting with John Lennon. And again, this is nuts. The principals don't kind of get together. And so he requests a meeting with John Lennon, which is held, takes place on the 8th of October, 1974 at the Club Cavallero on East 58th Street in New York. So this is a private club run by Morris Levy's associates.
Yes, and again, it's the eve of John's 34th birthday. So we're a year on from the agreement made around the time of his 33rd birthday. And as you say, again, it's another example of John not picking up the phone to his lawyer as soon as Levy enters his orbit, which is what he should have done, and saying, yeah, I'll go off and I'll meet Levy. Yeah. So across the 8th and 9th of October, he has this interaction with Levy that, well, I think Levy thinks he's reached an agreement, but legally it's not very robust.
This is what the subsequent litigation will really turn on. What happened that night? What happened on the 8th of October? What happened the following day on the 9th of October? What was agreed? What wasn't agreed? Was there any
also,
kind
what
of,
was John in a position to agree?
And that's the thing. What did John think he was agreeing to, and what was he legally able to agree to?
Yes, which are, you know, separate things. And, you know, John is a fast talker. You know, we all love John Lennon, but he would talk. He would talk maybe without always following through on the consequence of his words. And, you know, he was charming and, you know, could tell people things they wanted to hear or make people think they were hearing.
Yes.
Hear.
And I think that for me, there are parallels here with his initial contact with Alan Klein. You know, people do say that Levy was a charming character, you know, and you think over the years, Lennon has just been fascinated by strong characters, you know.
Yeah.
And you think, well, the same things that first attracted him to Alan Klein, the kind of tough street talking, the New York thing, probably played in as well. He's talking to Levy. He's in this kind of private club, which is, you know, like something that we will see subsequently in The Sopranos. You think that's got to kind of tick some boxes, and he's going to think, wow, I'm kind of moving in this in these circles. And Levy says at one point he actually arranged to get John membership of this club because he liked it so much, so that he wanted to be able to come back there. And you kind of think it's all a game. It's he's playing out a kind of character role. It's role play.
Yeah. So do we need to talk about what the Beatles were able to deliver as per their September 1969 agreement first? Because that's the background as to what Levy thinks he's able to do.
Yes.
So famously, Alan Klein, one of the big things he did deliver that was useful for the Beatles was their September 1969 revised contract with EMI, which gave them control over, you know, their US releases, you know, that they could standardize international releases. Yeah. It increased their royalty rate hugely. But there was also things to do with licenses that Apple had versus EMI.
Yes. And I absolutely do not purport to understand the absolute morass of agreements here. But there was a summary in the final judgment, which covers some of this. So the background is that Capitol is the distributor in North America for Beatles records by the Beatles and individual members. EMI is the regular distributor everywhere else. So the key point was that Levy was claiming that under that September 1969 arrangement, Apple, not Capitol, but Apple had kept the rights to distribute records by mail order in North America. And that both he and Lennon knew that, and that was the basis that, you know, because one of Levy's big things was TV mail order sales. You know, you see the compilations of hits of the 50s and all the rest of it.
Yeah.
And he was making a lot of money doing that. So he had that infrastructure to market albums on television and send them out by mail order. And his understanding, and he said Lennon's understanding, was that Apple had that right in North America, not Capital.
Now, it does seem odd that John Lennon would know the fine print that Apple had the rights to mail order records in North America. And some of this is thought to be, you know, not mail order in the way you describe, but mail order in this kind of, as used to be the Columbia House, 12 records for a dollar type mail order, that they had a bit of coverage and supply to that market.
That's it. But there are exceptions. And again, the exceptions include distribution by mail direct to consumers. Mm-hmm. And as you say, Levy claimed in his testimony that Alan Klein had told him that
about the mail order thing,
that Capitol was not, the consent from Capitol was not required to be able to do this. And the One of the sources that Levy relies on is a published interview with Alan Klein in the November 1971 issue of Playboy, if you're flicking through your Playboy.
Let me just look on my shelves here. Yeah, I'm just magazines. Taking it down now. Yep.
It's volume 18.
Yes.
Number 11, page 98. Presumably much like the London Times in the UK as a publication of record, I think, for the American justice system, Playboy is a publication of record. So Alan Klein said, we had them. We worked out a new contract. We got the boys increased royalties. But more important than that, we got them total control and ownership of their product in America. So total control and ownership of their product in America. The most interesting thing is he's referring to them as the boys, which I thought was... He's a bit of a
Brianism.
He's echoing Brian, yeah.
It brings back again, because as we tell this story, there's an awful lot of parallels with My Sweet Lord. And one of them is the role of Alan Klein as a broker in all of this, and that he's not a totally honest broker. He's not a wise broker in defending for the people he's supposed to represent. And the fact that, you know, Alan Klein is telling Levy that, by the way, there's a loophole here where, you know, we have control over the mail order distribution of records is a very odd thing to do. Like, why would he give Levy that piece of information?
Well, in March 1973, Klein is out,
of course, and he's looking for vengeance.
And well, potentially, I think he's kind of constantly just one of those guys that's just looking for the main chance. He's just constantly looking for money. You know, aren't we all?
Well, he does seem to be one of these types who just, you know, opens his mouth without consequence, and
one day we're going to do an Alan Klein podcast, and I'm going to defend Alan Klein. But he did a lot of good things, he did a lot of bad things, but everything he did benefited Alan Klein. That's I think the point. And even when there was this very contentious litigation going on following his removal as manager in March 73, he keeps up a good relationship with Lennon. But you just imagine he's still there, he's still moving in those circles, and he's inserting himself into this negotiation. You know, he's still playing both sides in the same way that he tried to do, we talked about in the My Sweet Lord litigation. He's just constantly playing both sides in his own favour.
So we're back in October 74. It's the eve of John Lennon's birthday. John Lennon is meeting with the opposition, Maurice Levy, to try and say, look, I'm sorry, my next album was Walls and Bridges. Let's figure something out, because that's not what I agreed to a year before. And this kind of kicks into play a sequence of events that happens quite quickly, because I think we can say this is October 74. Rock and Roll, the album, comes out in February 75. So a very, like, it's weeks. But what happens in these weeks is kind of crazy. So what happens with the Lennon-Levy meeting?
So it seems common ground that the possibility of him completing the Rock and Roll album and then having it marketed by Levy through TV promotion was discussed. And, you know, we know that John is, you know, a big fan of TV, and he seems to have been interested in this, because one of the things that comes out is they're saying that John felt that the delay in the completion of the album would lead to it not being particularly well received. And this is this point that the kind of 50s nostalgia from 73 had started to dissipate. He was attracted to the idea of using a different means of production and distribution. So undoubtedly, Lennon is expressing some interest in this. He then says to Levy, well, why don't you come by the studio tomorrow and you can hear, you know, I want
the Spectre rock and roll tapes.
Yeah, I want to prove to you essentially that I wasn't acting in bad faith. I did record your songs. So again, a completely nuts idea. You know, you invite Levy into the studio. So October the 9th, there's some kind of listening event. There's a birthday bash going on for Lennon in the studio. Weirdly, Alan Klein is there, despite all the lawsuits kind of swirling around. And John plays the three songs for Levy. But what he also does is play the rest of the tape.
Yeah.
So he will say, well, two things. One, I didn't want to just kind of say, right, you've heard your three songs, get out. But he also wanted to say, look, this is shockingly bad, and this is why Spectre had the tapes. That was one reason that it didn't come out as my next album, but also it's not very good.
And so it's very odd to think it's John Lennon's 34th birthday. Levy and Klein are in the room. They're having this big bash. They're playing this tape, and the general consensus is that it's not very good. But Lennon obviously had nothing in his calendar, because what happens next happens quite quickly, which is 5 days later, Lennon and Levy meet again at the club.
Yeah.
And Levy, maybe to mollycoddle Lennon, I think has made him a member at this point, or has bought him membership because he likes it. And totally normally, Levy says, "I have a farm. Why don't you come up to my farm and record or re-record or, you know, add to the recordings for your rock and roll album or rehearse with your band up in my barn?" That's on the 14th of October. And he goes up to the barn 4 days later.
Yes,
with the band.
Yes. And May Pang has said Lennon did not want to do this. He was determined, went into that meeting on the 14th, determined not to kind of get drawn further in. So she said she got up, went to the powder room, came back, and Lennon had agreed to go and rehearse the entire band. So he moves the musicians, who include Klaus Voormann and Jim Keltner and Jesse Ed Davis, the people who they all just head up to this barn.
You'd think Levy, being a bit of an odd character, would have bugged the whole thing. It was the era of being bugged.
If I had been Morris Levy, I'd have had microphones everywhere.
And I like the fact that you said that Mick Jagger had a name for the album at this point.
Yes. So if you also touched in 74, John had worked recording with Mick Jagger.
Too many cooks and all that.
So Mick Jagger had said, got a old hat.
Old hat is a very funny name.
It's a bit disparaging. It's like Eric Clapton's old sock. Which was suggested by David Bowie, apparently.
Oh yeah, that was David Bowie's nickname for Eric Clapton.
Yeah, but he said, "Call your album Old Sock."
That's the worst album cover ever. So this leads to 2 days in the barn on the 18th and 19th of October, leads to 4 days or five days in the record plant, October the 21st, the 25th. Where basically Lennon records 9 tracks: Bebopalula, Stand By Me, Ready Teddy Rip It Up, Ain't That a Shame, Do You Want to Dance, Slip and Slide, and Peggy Sue, Bring It Home to Me, Send Me Some Love, and Yeah Yeah. So these are all kind of re-recorded across these 5 days. So from it's ridiculous that he meets Levy on the 8th of October in this club, and then by the 25th of October, he's coming out of the record plant and he's recorded all of these songs again, ready to go.
Absolutely. Now, what you have to remember is that he's working with the same band and the same musicians that he's just finished recording Walls and Bridges. So he's got a kind of crack band. These are old rock and roll standards, and they just kind of slot very neatly into doing this.
So Lennon records all these songs in the record plant, has rough mixes done of the sessions, has them all on a tape. And of course, the sensible thing to do is to, pass this tape on to Morris Levy just to have a listen to say, this is where we're going with this, these rough mixes. Nothing bad can come of passing him that rough tape.
No. When you say sensible, you're using that word in entirely the wrong sense there. He gives him this tape. No, it's a kind of listening tape. It's a 7.5-inch tape, that it would have been recorded originally on maybe, I think it's 15-inch tape. Mm-hmm. So it's not broadcast quality, but he gives all of this, and it's a kind of, rough mix.
And I think it's Lennon's trusting nature to say, look, I am doing the work. Here's the work. Here's where we're going. We're getting out the other side. That's fine. What could possibly go wrong? So I think, why don't we just take a little break, because everything's going so well.
Perfect.
Back in a bit.
End of part one. Intermission.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
End of intermission, part two.
Welcome back. So it's mid-November 74. Morris Levy has a rough mix just for his own personal use. He's not going to do anything with that, just so he can listen to the rock and roll record. And as we've said, all this crazy stuff happens towards the end of 1974. We've talked about this before, but something we didn't mention in the 74 episode is, but we've talked about it in our Sgt. Pepper episode, is that the Broadway opening of Sgt. Pepper, the musical, happens in November 74. And it's possible that John was there and Paul was there and Morris Levy were there at various nights, potentially.
Levy's lawyer recounts the fact that John was there, Paul was there, Levy was there, Klein was there, all kind of separately. And the lawyer kind of recounts, you know, people nodding across the foyer at each other. You know, all these people who are engaged in litigation and business meetings all turn up at the one at the one event. Yeah.
So what obviously is going to happen is that, you know, Levy has this tape and thinks he has the rights to put out a John Lennon mail order album. And what John Lennon doesn't perhaps realize or appreciate is that, you know, he is signed to EMI. He doesn't have the right to make that decision to basically record an album and pass the tapes onto another label. That's not how recording contracts work. So, but Levy is going to proceed in this direction that he's going to get his mail order album.
Yes, and I think this is one of the things that's very evident, is that Lennon is kind of treating this quite casually, whereas Levy is beavering away in the background, pressing on. So he meets with a guy called Harold Sider, who used to be one of Klein's sidekicks, but had left Klein's employ shortly before, I think, Klein was parting company with the Beatles. So Harold Sider is now working for Lennon, and Levy meets with him and says, you know, you've got to go and speak to EMI. You've got to get the permissions that are necessary. And there does seem to have been a discussion about what Levy's costs would be in producing the record and promoting the record, what would be available for Levy's profit, Lennon's royalty rate, all the rest of it. So there is a discussion going on at this stage, ostensibly by one of Lennon's representatives, but it's all very casual at this point. Also in November, we're obviously leading up to the Beatles' dissolution papers being signed. And if you remember from the 1974 episode, November the 19th is the big day. This is George's Madison Square Gardens concert. George and Paul are in the hotel room.
Yep, that footage comes from where they're signing the documents.
You know, there are lots of kind of other, Neil Aspinall is in there. There's lots of other people in that room representing everybody. John sends his balloon along saying, listen to this balloon, and doesn't show up.
George is playing his two gigs at Madison Square Garden. Then a week later for Thanksgiving, it's the famous John Lennon turns up with Elton John at Thanksgiving in Madison Square Garden. He reconnects with Yoko afterwards to some degree. But
To some degree,
because at Christmas, he's still on holidays with May Pang in Disneyland, where he famously, apparently, possibly signs the Beatles dissolution papers.
Yes. And they were Levy's guests in Palm Beach.
Yeah, so they're so again, this is circular. 10 years earlier, they're in Florida in Levy's swimming pool. 10 years later, Lennon is in Florida, Levy's guest again. And you know, Levy is still pursuing this rock and roll album, but he's not going near EMI. He's just doing his own shady.
He is. He's still in contact with this guy Harold Sider, and he's still saying, you know, you've got to do this, you've got to do this. But there are no conversations taking place between Sider and EMI or Capitol at this stage. That he won't actually start to action this until 1975. And you do get the sense of there being kind of like two trains running at different speeds. So, you know, Levy is just full steam ahead. He wants this done. He is whining and dining John Lennon. He's giving him hospitality at Disney. You've got to think, well, was John just kind of casual? You know, I suppose since 1963, people just give them things. They just, you get free hotels. You get the use of a swimming pool. There was no quid pro quo for using Levy's swimming pool in 1964. And it gives you, I think, a little bit of an insight into just the way Lennon was living his life at that stage.
But finally, you get to the last day, the 31st of December, 1974, which should have been a nice relaxing day. But if people have been paying attention, a little bomb goes off on the last day of 1974, because that was the day that John Lennon had agreed with his best efforts to hand over some Apple songs to Levy for no particular reason, which he had no particular right to do. And he offered Levy songs like "Those Were the Days," "Carolina on My Mind," "Come and Get It," and Levy turns them all down. And so...
yeah, he turns them all down. So yeah, on that last day of 74, his lawyers write, sort of saying, right, this is, we're going ahead with the second phase of that settlement from October 73. So one of the important things there is that Lennon's lawyers at least are acting on the basis that that 1973 settlement is still in place. You know, there were two kind of heads to that settlement. The first was to record on the next album, and then to do this with these Apple songs.
But then there's this unofficial 1974 agreement, which the parties are kind of like Lennon and Levy are just doing their own thing.
That's it, and this is where all of the argument will come. Was there actually an agreement? You know, a verbal agreement, and you know, people joke about, oh, you know, an oral contract or a verbal agreement isn't worth the paper it's written on. You can certainly have an enforceable oral agreement. And that really is what it comes down to. But that issue around the Apple songs actually was one of the points that was being discussed in the run-up to the dissolution papers for the Beatles. So apparently this was raised, you know, well, we have agreed to do this, so we've got to build this into the Beatles dissolution papers. And apparently George put his foot down, which I only read this last night. He apparently put his foot down and said, you will not transfer any of my Apple artists, Doris Troy, Billy Preston. So he puts his foot down and says, so that's why you've got, these are essentially Paul's artists. Those Were the Days, Mary Hopkins, Carolina on My Mind, Paul, Come and Get It. So George is saying, keep me out of it. Keep my guys out of it.
Harry Krishna. Yeah. Stay on the label, Harry Krishna. It's mad. It's mad that Lennon is flying blind, that it's so ad hoc that he's got one agreement in October 73, but he's going off an oral agreement in October 74. You know, Klein can't really be trusted in all this. He's playing both sides. And Levy kind of shows his hand in January 75, because he then puts in writing, actually, I have this oral agreement from October 74, which is going to kind of supersede what I'd agreed in writing a year earlier. And I'm going to put out a Lennon record. And he shows his hand and says, I'm going to do this by television advertising. I'm going to put out that's the first time I think that he expresses it to the outer world that this is about to happen.
That's it. So that's on the 9th of January. They write in these terms. So you're right. This is where anybody looking at this will see, okay, these two trains that have been running in parallel are about to hit each other. There's a crash coming.
Now, parallel to this, though, John is putting together a rock and roll album for Capitol. So as in John's mind, I don't know if he really understands that two albums are about to come out, because in John's mind, he is putting together the cover for the rock and roll album as we all know it today. And, you know, he's meeting with the Capitol Art Department and he's trying to put together a nice cover. And it's the cover of rock and roll. It's unusual that it's so, what's the word? Retrospective, really.
Yeah. It's a Jürgen Vollmer photograph taken in Hamburg, in that sort of famous shot in the doorway. And then Capitol, their art department, get a sort of a neon sign above it. And there's a kind of blurred figures walking through it. And for years, I didn't realize that was the other Beatles at the time.
That's the Beatles. The Beatles are on the cover of Rock and Roll, which is it's kind of nice, really, that they're there.
Yeah. Yeah,
that they are the other guys.
But there's a kind of history of, you know, there's the girl at the back of Abbey Road is kind of blurred walking across. You just get the blue miniskirt, or there's that Neil Young after the Gold Rush. You get like a little old lady walking past. And so this is the thing at the time, a bit of a trope at the time to have kind of figures walking.
Have you seen the full After the Gold Rush picture?
Yes.
Graham Nash is in it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So this is a photograph that Jürgen Vollmer took. He was paid $500 in 1974. And if you remember, we talked in 1974 episode about the Beatle Fest.
Yes.
So this was May Pang bought that photograph, bought a copy of that photograph for John at that
Beatle Fest.
And that's so it was in his mind. And I looked up some information about Jürgen Vollmer. He is 82 years old. As of the date of recording. He was one of the Astrid Kleiss Exes, you know, the Exes axis. And he was at the Hamburg School of Fashion, and he took almost as many iconic photographs as Astrid. There's a very, you know, that photograph where you can see George, John, and Paul sort of sideways on stage, where they're all sort of slightly angled.
Yeah.
It turns up on the Hamburg Star Club bootlegs. He took that. A couple of books, Beatles in Hamburg, very hard to find. Copy 1978, I think it came out, but photographs. So very, very influential, but not as well known as Astrid.
And another suggestion at the time was John was going to do a parody of Elvis's 50 Million Elvis Fans Can't Be Wrong with his own head. That's a cover that's been parodied a lot.
That would have been terrible.
That would have been terrible. It's a joke that was subsequently used on compilations by The Fall and Bon Jovi, which is not a duets album. They're two separate albums.
So disappointed to learn that they hadn't done a duets album.
And Living on a Prayer would be what they'd be called. Anyway, so John is putting together a legitimate Capitol rock and roll record. But Levy is eventually told at the end of January, you know, in an amusingly way, you can't do that.
Oh, see what you did there.
See what I did there? I was building up to that joke.
Oh, right. Sorry, I didn't give you enough space for that joke to breathe.
You can't do that. So this chap, Cedar, tells Levy that, you know, you can't do that. You can't distribute a John Lennon album by telemarketing without EMI's say-so on your own volition from a dodgy tape that you were given back in November.
Yep, and that's the end of that.
No, what happens is TV ads start to appear.
Yes. So February the 7th, he starts running ads for this album through his mail order label called Adam 8. Adam was his son. So John Lennon sings the great rock and roll hits Roots. That's runs trips off the tongue.
And it's $4.98 for an LP and $5.98 for a tape. And it's generally run in the New York, Northeast US area. It's not a national campaign. And, you know, nothing, whatever cards he's been playing close to his chest, as soon as that ad goes live, the you know what hits the fan, more or less. So he's basically told to stop. And the ad only runs for a couple of days in the end.
It does. And Capitol kind of really, shift up a gear. They release their version of rock and roll on the 15th of February. In a direct response, they bring everything forward. Usually they would be selling albums at $6.98. They sell this one at $5.98 to compete. They write letters, cease and desist letters to TV and radio stations saying if you broadcast this ad, we're going to sue you. This is a bootleg you're advertising. And essentially, the production and distribution of Levy's album comes to a halt. So there are not before 3,000 copies have been pressed and about 1,200 have been sold.
It's hard to, I was looking on Discogs, you know, if you want to buy a copy of, let's read that title out again, John Lennon Sings the Great Rock and Roll Hits, Roots. It's about $75 to $100, but you do have to wonder, you know, there are many bootlegs of this bootleg out there purporting to be the real thing. It's like stumbling across a butcher cover of yesterday and today. Most of them have been put there by, you know, they've been printed last week.
That does seem very cheap, given that there are only supposedly 1,250 of these in the world. I have a copy of that on CD. It's a terribly garish.
They had CDs in 1975?
Apparently so.
No, the cover is horrific. It's this garish yellow cover with about a 1968, I think, kind of picture of John with his long hair.
I think it might be from the Rock and Roll Circus.
Yeah. Yeah, that would make sense.
Era. But it's just the cheapest, tackiest thing. And the CD has faithfully reproduced it in all its terribleness.
Awful glory. It's. But here's the thing, because this wasn't by any stretch the end of the affair, because when the official rock and roll album comes out, it does feature Yeah Yeah. We'll put a tick beside that. Tick. It does feature You Can't Catch Me. Tick. But it does not feature a third Morris Levy copyright, which was the deal. The 1973 yes. deal was three copyrights because Angel Baby had been removed from the final track listing.
Yes. And again, this makes no sense to me. You would think they could, you know, they were rattling these songs off at great speed over the course of a 4 or 5 day session. They could very easily have re-recorded Angel Baby or another Big Seven copyright. Yeah. But this doesn't even fulfill the terms of the 1973.
By only having the two songs. Yeah. It's again, if we go back to that 73 settlement, there was two parts, record three songs for the next album and hand over some Apple songs. Yeah. And he's now recorded two songs for his next but one album. And so, you know, Morris Levy, instead of jumping on his horse and going off into the sunset, decides more lawyers. And so there is a further, this is the real crazy bit of litigation that happens next, because this goes from 75 to 77.
Yes, this is the big litigation. So in 1975, Levy sues. At this time, he's asking for $42 million for breach of the oral agreement that supposedly was made in the dodgy club on the 8th of October.
And $42 million was what he was about to make on that mail order album.
Well,
he was going to sell.
Clearly,
he was going to sell 20 million odd copies.
Yeah.
This is a version of I Want, you know, Come Together Destroyed and Blasted into Space.
Absolutely.
Opening gambits. But Lennon countersues legitimately.
He does. So for once, Lennon kind of goes in, tooled up with lawyers, and he countersues for unauthorized use of his name, his likeness, the recordings, damages to his reputation, basically because the tapes are poor and the shoddiness of the packaging. And this is an honest-to-goodness fight.
Fight. At this point, it is 1975. John is now John and Yoko. Yoko is pregnant, as in Yoko and Sean.
Yeah.
And when the trial kicks in full tilt, Yoko is doing her sitting quietly routine again. We all love it, knitting in the courtroom.
Yes.
As this proceeds, which is great.
It kind of conjures up an image of, you know, women at the guillotine and the French Revolution.
And so what, because the first trial, it's all a bit strange. There's a mistrial, or it all sort of rushes through, or what happens?
Well, if you want me to go through the tedious legal arguments, I'm going to have to start the clock running. And
No. I just need some advice.
Some advice. Okay.
That's all. What would you do?
Very brief. Yeah. What would you do if it was your dad was being sued for? Well, Lennon's argument is that the cover photograph is terrible. And one of the amusing things is that when he turns up in court, he has very, very short hair. So he's had his hair cut, you know, nice short back and sides to be a kind of, again, I imagine the lawyer said, this would be a good idea. Get your hair cut.
And, remember what Paul did when Apple had the bankruptcy guys in? Do that.
Levy's lawyer gets Lennon on the witness stand and says, you only cut your hair because of this trial. And Lennon says, that's rubbish. I cut it every 18 months. And everyone, including the judge, bursts out laughing in an amusing Ally McBeal sort of way.
But there's one point Levy's lawyer holds up two virgins to say, you know, you don't care about packaging. You don't care about what you look like on the cover.
Yes.
And the judge goes a bit nuts.
The judge goes completely nuts. Now, this album cover has already been entered in as a potential piece of evidence. So he should know this is coming. The judge gets really annoyed. He throws the LP in a bin and then says, it's a mistrial. This is Judge Lloyd McMahon. And he declares a mistrial. And the whole thing has to be stopped. And they have to bring in a new judge.
And who do they get?
Judge Thomas Greaser.
Remember, folks, he's the guy who missed out in October 1973. He missed out on his trial because of the eve of court settlement.
So that was nice.
It is nice. He gets to hang out with John for a bit. At which point then does John take the stand at this point, or is that later on?
No, he is on the stand when they produce this album, and then there's a mistrial is declared, and then they kind of start again, essentially.
Okay.
Klein gives evidence. You know, again, this is court proceedings that you would want to have a front row seat.
Well, you sent me some paperwork from what was the book you got it from?
This is called "Baby, You're a Rich Man."
And, yes.
It's a very good book, and it kind of covers the, you know, top 10 lawsuits involving the Beatles.
And Lennon takes the witness stand on January the 20th, 1976. And it's a quite a fascinating bit of testimony that he gives throughout all of this. You know, for starters, you know, by the time we get to 76, Sean has been born. And he is withdrawing slowly from the music business. So he's you know, year on year from 73, 74, 75, 76, he's moving slowly into a different space. And he says a couple of things when he's on this witness stand at this point that are really quite revelatory.
Yes. It's a fascinating account. One of the first things he does is he talks a bit about the Spectre sessions and about how bad that is, and then he talks about choosing the various songs that will end up on the record. And there was some bits and pieces in this testimony that I'd never heard in interviews. So he says, you know, Bebopalula was one of the first songs I ever learned, and I actually remember singing it the day I met Paul McCartney.
And he talks about some of his other songs and the reasons why he chose some of them.
Yeah. So Ain't That a Shame? He said, this was the first rock and roll song I ever learned. My mother taught it to me on the banjo before I learned the guitar. He says, I put Peggy Sue on the album because I used to sing every Buddy Holly song there was. And Sam Cooke's Bring It On Home, because that's a song I really wish I'd written it. I love it that much. This is a very kind of poignant thing as well. He includes a cover of Larry Williams' Boney Maroney, and he says, and the direct quote is, I remember singing it the only time my mother saw me perform before she died.
Yeah, and I'd never heard him say that in an interview, and to actually read it through court testimony is quite extraordinary. And the other fun bit, I thought, you know, reading this was, he's asked, have the Beatles or you as artists ever had what you refer to as dead material? And Lennon says, one thing the Beatles and me never like, Lennon confessed, is the idea of having a lot of material that is crummy and left in the vaults for when you die in an airplane crash, which is what a lot of rock and roll people do. When they release this material, they put strange people playing on it, which happened to artists such as Buddy Holly. The Beatles may have two tracks that were never released, and one of them is from 1962. I guess he's thinking about One After 909 or something. And I have one. And there is the Spectre tape, which he's talking about, the rock and roll tapes. But he's literally foreshadowing everything that we're buying these days, that he is saying, you know, when I die, I don't want people touching up any of my crummy old bits of recording.
Yeah, he actually says, I have three that they could release if I died, which I would hate to have released.
Free as a bird. No, which obviously doesn't exist yet. He hadn't recorded Free as a Bird yet, so he didn't know what he was talking about, obviously. But it's really, 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 you know, striking. And, you know, it's 1976, as I said, where you think he's house husband, but he's still involved in all of this kind of stuff. He's also involved in his immigration court work as well at the same time. So how does all of this, what is the final judgment in all of this? What happens?
Okay, well, essentially, just to summarize that judgment, the judge says there was a tentative agreement, clearly a tentative agreement, for Lennon to provide 15 or 16 rock and roll songs in the event that Lennon, in fact, made a record album for Levy. So it's all conditional. However, the judge finds that Levy has not shown that there was any agreement on the amount or method of calculation of the royalty. No contract was made at the October 8th meeting for Lennon and Apple to produce a record for distribution by Levy. There was no agreement to abandon the October 1973 settlement, and it is unnecessary to describe the various other subjects that were discussed. So essentially, there was no contract between Levy and Lennon. But interestingly, Dawes say that the 1973 agreement remained in place. But there is one really interesting thing. In the dissolution agreement with the Beatles, which we remember wasn't being signed until late November, and ultimately John doesn't sign it until after Christmas.
December,
That agreement actually provided that the effective date for the kind of splitting of the income was the 1st of October 1974. So effectively, from the 1st of October 1974, all of the income, or the income that each of the Beatles made solo, would go to the relevant Beatle. Up to that point, all of the income from, you know, All Things Must Pass, Sentimental Journey, Imagine, Band on the Run, all went into Apple and was split four ways. Why did they choose the 1st of October 1974? Why did they put that date? Levy's argument was that that date was to allow Lennon to get all of the money from the record that he agreed to give to Levy on the 8th of October.
Yeah.
And that that was the key date. And you, and the judge said, I've looked at this. I do not believe that that has been established, that there's a link between the 1st of October and the 8th of October, and that that's what was in Lennon's mind or his lawyer's mind. But you've got to think, why the 1st of October? What was...
Well, the only, well, it could be a, could it just be a financial reporting thing? Because it's the end of one quarter and the start of the next quarter. That's what I was wondering, you know, something as mundane as that. So yeah, it is curious that technically, financially, the Beatles split on the 1st of October, 1974. So what the judge is saying in the final argument is that, you know, October 73 is the bit that's in writing.
Yep.
October 74 is not in writing. So October 74, you know, at best it was an exploratory meeting and agreement, but nothing was written down. And it's the October 73 thing that is written down that applies, which is I'm recording three songs for my next album, but also I'm giving you some songs from Apple. But obviously, Levy doesn't get the songs from Apple and he only gets the two songs recorded on the album. So, but the judge gives a very, very, very minor, trifling financial agreement to Levy for that breach of what was agreed in 1973.
Yes, so you remember that John is countersuing. So the judge hears that. And I mean, effectively what he's saying is there was no agreement in 74 at all. So basically he says that Lennon is to pay Levy $6,795 for breach of the 1973 agreement. And that would cover both the not being on his next album, plus only being having recorded
two songs.
Levy is to pay Lennon $100,000 to compensate for the lost income from rock and roll because Roots is competing. Now, there is an appeal on the amount of damages, and that's ultimately reduced to $50,000. But Levy is also to pay $35,000 in punitive damages for harming Lennon's reputation, and Capital get $290,000 in damages. Now, you think, what was Levy looking for originally? $42 million.
$42 million, I know. It's. I mean, it's very favourable towards John Lennon. It gets him off the hook completely.
Yes.
And, you know, it kind of, you know, reading between the lines, it kind of reads to me like, you know, Lennon is seen as someone who maybe got taken advantage of a little bit. And, you know, the judge is saying enough's enough. We're calling this off now. And, you know, by issuing the Roots album, Levy probably did himself the most harm. If he hadn't put Roots out and had gone to court as an honest broker saying, where are my three songs? I haven't had my three songs. He might have done better. But by putting Roots out, he shows himself as being maybe a bit unethical, or, you know, not really caring about the what was agreed in October 1973. He's just out for short-termism, fast-buckism.
I think that's absolutely right. I think that's absolutely right. One fun fact arriving out of the court case is that after the decision is delivered, Levy's attorney, William Shurtman, goes up to Lennon and asks him to autograph the copy of Two Virgins that the judge threw in the bin.
I think Lennon had already been signing stuff for the kids of the lawyers already.
Yes. So some statistics, just to put the whole thing in context. Yeah. Rock and roll reaches number 6 in the UK and in America. It does go gold over, but it took 10 years to go gold, to sell 500,000 copies. It was amongst the lowest selling studio albums of Lennon's career, slightly above the worst one, which was sometime in New York City. So initially, on initial returns, Walls and Bridges, which, remember, number one single. 425,000 copies in the States.
That's a lot.
Mind Games, 376,000 copies. Rock and Roll, 342,000 in the States. So not good. John, his final comment was, it started in 73 with Phil and fell apart. I ended up as part of a mad, drunk scene in Los Angeles, and I finally finished it off on my own. There were still problems with it up to the minute it came out. I can't begin to say it's just barmy. There is a jinx on that album.
Yeah, it's a bit like kind of Get Back, Let It Be, trying to do some loose-limbed stuff, and it just ends up kind of becoming a big albatross around his neck. You know, when you take the broad view of something like this, you always have to say who's the big winner, and it's obviously Paul McCartney.
Yes, it is. It is Paul McCartney.
Yeah, because he had the publishing for Peggy Sue, which is on the album, so he gets some money out of rock and roll no matter what.
That's it. Levy? Can we talk about Levy?
Yeah, so, well, there's a couple of interesting postscripts. One is what happens to Levy and what happens to Chuck Berry's copyrights.
Yes. So what happened to Levy? The Adam 8 name was discontinued, and Levy sold the Roulette label to Rhino in the late 80s. So those sort of Rhino issues. He was under investigation by the FBI in the 50s, but in 1986, he was finally indicted for conspiring with a Genovese boss to extort money from a music wholesaler. So there's a nice mafia family connection. He was convicted and sentenced to 10 years in prison, but while the case was on appeal, he passed away in 1990 at the age of 62.
I think his quote at the time was, he said to a friend, "Oh, this is how I'm going to get off the rap of going to jail. I'm just going to die," which is kind of amusing. Yeah, so this is Sugar Hill, as in the Sugar Hill Gang and hip-hop and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. That he was involved in what, funding that record label? Or
he owned that record label.
Really?
Yes. So we can say, you heard it first here, that the people who invented rap music were Paul McCartney and Morris Levy.
Well, yes. I think there was another lady called Sylvia Robinson involved in Sugar Hill, who was the main driver, but I think he was behind the scenes, Morris Levy, or he had money invested in Sugar Hill, which is pretty wild. So maybe that's what Paul was talking about when he said come together led to hip hop. I think that's probably what he meant.
That's probably it.
The other thing that happened in terms of the actual song You Can't Catch Me and the copyrights of You Can't Catch Me was that Chuck Berry eventually managed to get his copyrights back to him by the end of the 1970s. Chuck himself owned his publishing and owned You Can't Catch Me.
So he gets his copyrights back, which is a good thing. That's a good thing. What he also got was a lawyer called William Krasilowski. So Levy's lawyer ends up working for Chuck, having met him sort of through this case. And there's a fascinating postscript.
Well, the fascinating postscript is this chap, Krasilowski, is Chuck Berry's lawyer. As we mentioned earlier on, Lee Eastman is the lawyer for a certain Paul McCartney. And what Paul McCartney has spent the 1970s doing is amassing publishing from his favorite artists and the pre-rock and roll era. And Paul has a desire to own Chuck Berry's publishing.
Yeah.
So what happens?
Lee Eastman approaches Krasilowski and says, we're interested in buying this. Would you like to come for dinner to my house and we can kind of have a chat? And that dinner comes to pass, but the dinner is interrupted by a phone call.
Yeah, so he's trying to massage Chuck Berry's lawyer into selling the catalogue, and Lee Eastman is called by his client, Paul McCartney, in the middle of this dinner. And is it to discuss the impending purchase of the Chuck Berry catalogue, or is there a more pressing matter in play?
It is not to discuss the purchase of the catalogue. It is to say, I've been arrested and I'm in jail in Japan.
I had some dynamite weed in my bag.
Yes.
I'm terribly sorry.
This is again.
You
one
can
of those,
catch me.
You can catch me.
Yeah.
Hey. This is another one of those absolutely weird coincidences. So the day that Paul's lawyer is speaking to Chuck's lawyer, the dinner is interrupted by Paul languishing in a Japanese prison cell.
It's amazing how it's all connected, that from Come Together being in the studio to Paul McCartney calling his lawyer, talking to Chuck Berry's lawyer in a Japanese prison cell. It's all wild. And of course, the song Come Together, which is why we are talking here today, Stephen, it goes on to a great afterlife. I think it's obviously one of the Beatles songs that has endured. It's certainly in terms of modern streaming and Spotify playlists and all the rest, along with the other Abbey Road songs. You know, it's still hugely, hugely popular. You know, John performed it live. We mentioned in our Sgt. Pepper movie that, you know, Aerosmith had a hit with their version of it and their performance of it in the Sgt. Pepper movie. And there have been a couple of other versions that we should probably mention before we sign off. First one is Michael Jackson's version.
Yep.
Are you a fan?
I'm not a fan. I went to see that movie in the cinema.
You went to see Moonwalker in the cinema. Is this in the same cinema where you saw the Sgt. Pepper movie?
It wasn't.
Okay. Did you not learn your lesson from seeing the Sgt. Pepper movie?
It was a romantic obligation.
I see. Okay. It's a date flick, is it? Is that what you're telling me?
It was a date flick.
Yeah, am I right in thinking in the movie he dances with a claymation animal or something?
I remember it being a very long movie.
It didn't get a release, Jackson's version, until it got put onto his 2-CD history compilation in 1995. That's where it first kind of comes out to the main world. I don't really think it's very good, but what it was notable for at the time was obviously Jackson had bought the Beatle copyrights.
Yes.
And was doing Beatle songs because he felt he could generate cash for himself by owning Northern Songs in the late 80s.
And I saw a little comment on this, and it said it was one of only two songs by other famous artists that Jackson ever recorded. One was Come Together and the other one was Smile, written by Charlie Chaplin.
Charlie Chaplin, yeah.
And I thought, there's a third one.
There's a third one. Should I know this? Is this a test?
I think you should.
A third Michael Jackson cover version.
By a famous artist.
Well, go on, tell me.
Girlfriend.
Of course. Well, Jackson, you know, didn't write, like he didn't write Thriller. He didn't write loads of things. So he certainly, you know, could pick a good song. You know, we could probably spend a long time talking about the Michael Jackson, Sean Lennon overlap as well.
Yes, that's, yes. We'll just direct people to the Claypool Lennon Delirium song,
oh, yes.
Bubbles Burst.
Bubbles Burst, where Noel Fielding plays Michael Jackson in the video. It's quite strange.
Is it Noel Fielding or is it Theresa Villiers, former Secretary of State for Northern Ireland? I think that's an unanswered question.
But the final version, and it might be a case of things coming full circle, because as we did back in episode one, foreshadowing, he won Mojo Filter, that Paul McCartney is one of the smoking Mojo Filters in 1995. That records a version of Come Together. And this is in September 1995. There's a one-day recording session with the greatest and the good of UK music scene for an album called Help, which is a charity album for the charity War Child. And in Abbey Road Studio 2, Paul Weller, with a little bit of help from his band, and Noel Gallagher from Oasis, are recording a cover version of Come Together. And who tootles in from around the corner?
That'd be Paul.
Hey, Paul
so
comes
as you
in.
Say, it's the greatest and the good, and Noel Gallagher. yeah, so Paul, does he play the piano on that?
Well, it seems to me, the way I always read it was, I don't think the intention was that Paul was to be there. I don't think the day started with Paul being there. And, certainly at the time, Stella McCartney was hanging out with, her name just escapes me, the model lady, who was going out with Johnny Depp. Kate Moss, thank you very much. I just had a bit of a brain fog there.
The model lady.
The model lady. they were kind of all part of the recording Britpop Noel Gallagher scene and all the rest. And it might have been that Stella McCartney told her dad to get on board because this was a happening. And it turns out the Help album was a happening. It just had a 25th anniversary there. And it's an album I'm very fond of, but the version of Come Together is pretty kind of straightforward. But the footage is there. You can see the video. They're in Abbey Road. Paul is there. And I think he just came in and threw in a couple of backing vocals. He wasn't really playing any instruments.
Right. Okay. I thought he was playing the piano, but
he might have thrown on a few rough keyboards, but he's really just an add-on.
It's a pretty kind of lumpen version. You know, it's Oasis and Ocean Colour Scene, effectively, is the band. Paul McCartney. You know, was Johnny Depp there?
I think Johnny Depp might have been hanging around somewhere, maybe. Certainly Kate Moss was there. And as I said, Stella was there as well. And, you know, it's if you look at the pictures from the day, there's a picture of the three of them, Weller, McCartney and Gallagher together. And Paul is in the middle with his arms around the other two. And the other two have the face on as if to say,
oh, my God, okay. It's Paul McCartney.
And if you remember your Britpop history, because some of us lived it, Stephen, you know, 1995 is peak Oasis. You know, they are, you know, they're post their What's the Story Morning Glory album, and you know, they're the biggest thing in the music scene. They're a year off from their big Nebworth gigs, but to actually have, you know, Noel Gallagher on a record with Paul McCartney and them hanging out, it's kind of like the fulfillment of all of this kind of stuff. So it's not a surprise that they're happy. But you look at that picture, the three of them today, and today, Noel Gallagher is the age that Paul McCartney was then. Time, eh?
Time. It's a funny thing, time.
Time. So that's the Smoke and Mojo Filters Come Together. Worth checking out the Help album if you haven't heard it already. There's nice stuff on there from, I'm thinking of stuff from Suede. And it's where Radiohead originally recorded the song Lucky. But I think we're heading off topic, aren't we? I think so. So we've come a long way from John Lennon being in bed with Timmy Leary chewing the fat to ending up in a New York courtroom paying Morris Levy $6,000 after recording a somewhat catastrophic album of rock and roll covers. It's all interconnected. But what do you think, folks? You know, can we send you back to the records? You know, there's a lot of things to listen to there. Come Together and the rock and roll album and all the stuff in between. We're available in all the usual places. We're on Twitter at BeatlesPod, the Nothing's Real Facebook group, the website www.nothingsrealpod.com with all our social stuff and all the other things that we've been involved in, and on Instagram as well. You can join us there. But for now, I'm Jason Carty.
I'm Stephen Cockcroft.
And this has been Nothing Is Real. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Thanks for listening to Nothing Is Real. We hope you enjoyed today's episode, and if you did, why not become a member? You'll get access to ad-free content, bonus episodes, and so much more. Follow the link in the show notes, sign up on Acast Plus, or visit our website, nothingisrealpod.com.